Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
Alas, now o'er the civilized world there hangs a gloom for brave General Gordon that was killed in Khartoum. He was a Christian hero and a soldier of the cross, and to England his death will be a very great loss. He was very cool in temper, generous and brave, the friend of the poor, the sick and the slave. And many a poor boy he did educate, and laboured hard to do so early and late. The inimitable poetic style of friend of the show, William McGonagall, whose great masterpiece on the disaster of the Tay Bridge we've already featured on The Rest is History in our 12 Days of Christmas episode. And Dominic, the death of General Gordon, the archetypal Victorian hero, at Khartoum in Sudan on the 26th of January, 1885, was seen as a disaster fit to rank with the Tay Bridge disaster, wasn't it?
Oh, a far greater disaster than the Tay Bridge disaster, Tom. The death of Gordon at Khartoum is one of the absolute emblematic moments of the Victorian era. It's an extraordinary shock to Victorian Britain. It's one of the great media events of the Victorian age. And General Gordon is one of the absolute kind of emblematic martyrs of the British Empire, one of the most famous men in the world, I would say, at the point that he died.
So fascinating you say that, because we've got a question from Stefan Jensen, another friend of the show, who's always popping up with his questions. I think he's been in abeyance recently, but he's back. And he says, who on earth is General Charles George Gordon?
What a thing to say, Stefan.
What a thing to say. Well, but I mean, I'll be honest. I mean, I have a kind of vague sense of him standing at the top of some steps with people with spears getting ready to spit in, the kind of famous archetypal image. But apart from that, I didn't really know a huge amount about him. But basically this week I've gone down General Gordon-shaped rabbit hole. They're really, really, it is a brilliant topic. And one of the things that is brilliant about Gordon is precisely what has happened to his subsequent reputation. So someone who is so famous is now not a name to play with, by and large. But also, Victorian hero, the archetype of a Christian Victorian hero, but then subsequently gets kind of skewered by Lytton Strachey in his famous, kind of famously feline volume of biographies of eminent Victorians. So what is it?
Dr. Arnold, Florence Nightingale, and
Cardinal
Newman?
Manning.
Cardinal Manning. One of the cardinals.
Yeah. So the question of how we're to understand Gordon, I mean, it kind of bleeds into the broader topic of how are we to understand the British Empire, all those, I mean, very kind of hot button issue.
Yeah.
And it kind of also feeds into the broader theme, which is the question of how reputations over the course of history have evolved, how some people go up, some people go down. And we are going to be talking about that live, are we not?
We are. That's a very nice link, Tom. We're doing a live show, aren't we, about reputations for Rest is History Club members. Now, maybe not everybody listening to this will know about the Rest is History Club. We may have some new listeners. But may have new listeners, Tom, who are attracted by the subject of General Gordon.
Yes, maybe.
And you know, we can open up to them the great vista of the Rest is History Club. So this is a club that you sign up to. Costs next to nothing, I would say. At restishistorypod.com, and you get basically all the episodes without adverts. You get access to archive without adverts. You get you come on this splendid thing called the Discord chat, where people chat about history. You get live streams with us and all kinds of goodies. I can't remember what the other goodies are, but I seem to remember they're absolutely tremendous.
Well, the particular goodie that we're talking about in this context is a live event on the question of reputation in history. That's this Wednesday, the 26th of January at 8 o'clock London time. And I'll tell you something else that you get if you become a club member, is that if you bump into me as two people did this morning at a conference, and you are club members, you get a shout out. So I'm going to give a shout out to James Farrow, who is a friend of the show, club member, and Ernie Wakeford, who is 13.
Oh, that's
and
nice.
And a club member. So that's splendid, isn't it?
Was this a hedgehog saving conference?
And Stonehenge Tunnel opposing.
Oh, very
yes.
good.
Yes.
All your causes yeah. wrapped into one.
Absolutely.
So we should go back to General Gordon.
Yes. Okay. So Stefan's question, who on earth is General Charles George Gordon? Dominic, do you want to give a kind of very brief resume of his career?
Golly, well, if you were giving a very brief resume, you would
say
just a
very brief one.
He's born in 1833. He dies in 1885. Gordon is the, in some ways for the British, the ultimate imperial hero. He sees action in this huge range of extraordinary places in the Crimean War. In China, he's present at the burning of the Summer Palace by British troops at the end of the Second Opium War. He then commands a small kind of almost paramilitary unit called the Ever Victorious Army in China. Fighting against the Taiping Rebellion, which is this kind of this massive and incredibly kind of bloody war involving a kind of heavenly cult, which Gordon helps to defeat. He goes to the Balkans. He goes to the Sudan. Then he has lots of other kind of adventures. And then he ends up going back to the Sudan. In 1884, the Sudan is racked with war and rebellion, and with this kind of jihadi group led by a fellow called the Mahdi, who thinks he's kind of a prophet, a chosen one, paving the way for the advent of, I think it's the advent of Jesus, is it, Tom?
It is, yeah.
The return
yeah.
of Jesus. And Gordon ends up trapped in Khartoum, in the capital of the Sudan, with the eyes of the world on him and the Mahdi's army closing in. The British are desperate finally to rescue him, but do they get there in time? Or we shouldn't give the end away, but basically there's a very dramatic denouement. And then after the story ends, Gordon becomes I don't think icon is the wrong word. I think icon is absolutely the right word,
yeah.
because he's the key thing about Gordon, apart from all this amazing imperial adventure story, is he's a religious figure. He sees himself as a religious figure. He thinks about religion every minute of every day. And the religious side of him has fascinated yeah. people ever since.
Yeah. So that second verse by McGonagall, it highlights the ambivalences in his life and in his reputation. So he was very cool in temper, generous and brave, the friend of the poor, the sick and the slave. And a key part of what he's doing in the Sudan is that he is fighting slavery. He is trying to abolish the slave trade. And this is something that he comes across very early in his career, because he gets seconded to Armenia, which is on the kind of frontiers of the Ottoman Empire. And he sees there for himself the slave trading, the obtaining of slaves from Armenia that the Ottomans are doing, getting slaves for Constantinople. So that is a theme that runs throughout his life.
Yeah.
And it's part of what's going on when he goes back to Khartoum. So he is kind of emblematically a figure who fights the slave trade.
He is a liberal. He is the ultimate liberal
imperialist. Liberal imperialist,
yeah. And actually, the funny thing about him is, as imperial heroes go, you were saying about his reputation dipping. But he's one of the, in some ways, I would say, one of the least likely to be cancelled.
Absolutely. And I think we will come, we'll come to this. But
yeah.
there is then the second, the other last three or four lines. And many a poor boy he did educate and laboured hard to do so early and late. And this is what Lytton Strachey fixes on in his biography. It's what Richard Davenport Hines in a recent biography of him, a kind of very short biographical sketch, describes him as a creep. Gordon never marries. He is notoriously, he gets kind of, he's very awkward with women.
Yeah.
But he does devote himself when he is in charge of the artillery at Gravesend in Kent. He devotes a lot of his time to charitable works and particularly working with raggedy boys, boys who are starving,
urchins.
He lets them into his garden. He helps with their education. He provides places on ships. He follows their careers with great interest. And of course, this is seen as a work of great Christian philanthropy. But for Lytton Strachey and for Richard Davenport Hines, it's seen as something altogether more sinister and suspicious. And so that also is a part of the complexity of his reputation, isn't it? And on top of that, there is a kind of rumor that he was an alcoholic. Yeah. His life is very contested. And I think that everything that makes the Victorians contested is kind of summed up by his career. And you suggested this, and I thought, I don't know about that. But honestly, it's a brilliant topic, and I completely commend
you for
it.
Before we get into the sort of narrative of it, Tom, there's a bit of a Hall of Mirrors side of kind of Gordon's career, isn't there? Because if you read, there are lots of biographies, but if you read three different biographies, they will give you three subtly different accounts of his life and motivations. It's actually very hard to get to a true picture of Gordon, I think, because it depends so much on what weight you put on different people's statements about him, on statements of his own. And it also, I think, so that you talk about Lytton Strachey and eminent Victorians. I mean, I think so much of that portrait of Gordon is kind of self-projection, actually.
Completely.
I think it, as we'll see, with the sort of the helping the poor boys, you know, a lot of your interpretation of Gordon is on what you're bringing to the table, completely. I think, and your expectations. Anyway.
Well, I think that it also, and it may not surprise you to hear me say this, I think it depends on how seriously you take Gordon's Christianity.
Yeah, I think
and whether you think that Gordon's Christianity is a kind of screen for predatory sexuality or all kinds of things, or whether you think that he
is sincere
and he means it.
Yeah.
So we can perhaps discuss that as we go.
So we will build up to the huge melodrama of the siege of Khartoum and the fall of Khartoum and the battle with the Mahdi and stuff. But maybe we should go into him, Gordon and his career first to give people a sort of sense of the background. So he's the son of a lieutenant colonel in the Royal Artillery. He's born in 1833 in Woolwich. He's brought up in a part of his childhood, Tom, in a place you know very well, in Corfu.
In Corfu, yeah.
So he probably played cricket in Corfu, I imagine, as you have.
He gets sent to a school in Taunton. Yeah. And the playing fields of this school are now the cricket ground of Somerset County Cricket Club.
Oh, that's always nice to have a bit of...
There's definitely a cricket link there, and Gordon was a keen cricketer.
Well, I'm glad for you that this has happened, because I did suggest this, and I know you were a little bit suspicious at first, but it's got Christianity and cricket. So basically, I could have designed it.
And Dominic, it's got eunuchs.
Yes, it has.
Because he made this fame, talking about his boyhood. He was quite a naughty boy, wasn't he?
He's a prankster.
He goes to the Royal Military Academy in Woolwich. So he's ran but the Arsenal that gives its name to the football club. Signs up to the Royal Engineers. But while he's there, he seems to have started to have kind of religious promptings.
Yeah.
And he famously said later on that at the age of 14, I wished I were an eunuch.
Yeah, it's an unusual. See, I get this is the first example, I think, of something that where it's very hard to know how to interpret that. Did he genuinely wish he were a eunuch? Is he making a remark about, he was struggling with kind of what he would see as sinful, lascivious longings? Because obviously he's going through puberty at 14. How much weight do you? I mean, it's impossible to know, isn't it, Tom? What he means?
Well,
I think
he clearly has kind of religious promptings. They're not dominating his life at this point, but they're clearly there. And I would guess the likeliest explanation would be that he is feeling urges to do things that are against, Christian teaching, whatever that is, having extramarital sex or whatever, who knows, gay sex. I mean, who knows? But then he gets, he qualifies, doesn't he? And gets posted to Pembroke.
Yeah.
To be an engineer at the docks. And there he is born again.
He is. He's born again. I seem to get the impression he's born again multiple times in his, or he goes through.
Well, there are two, periods, I think. There are periods two of kind of great awakening.
Intense, yeah, periods of intense religious awakening. This is the first he meets a man called Captain Drew, I think, who's an Irish Protestant, who sort of seems to semi-convert him. And
but this is, and it's the Protestant quality of it that is key, because it's this idea of the spirit descending, of Gordon feeling a sense of personal redemption. And in due course, he will have this sense that, you know, he's born into Christ. Yeah. And I think everything about his life suggests that he takes this completely, completely seriously.
Yeah, so when Lytton Strachey and Eminent Victorians portrayed him as a hypocrite and a charlatan, I think that is utterly, utterly wrong. Because everything we know about Gordon suggests that he is completely serious about this.
And this
matters to him enormously.
This amazing comment on him by someone who knew him, a friend, that he is without the three strongest passions which make men good or bad, the love of money, the love of fame, and the love of women. And, you know, those are kind of amazing. You know, it will be a theme throughout his career that he is utterly contemptuous of money. And whenever he's offered the salary for, you know, as leading men in China or Sudan or wherever, he rejects it, and he shares the money out among people who need it more. The love of fame, I mean, again, this has a kind of, you might think that someone who ends up the most famous man in the world, this would be a ludicrous thing to say, but again, so when he's in the Sudan the first time, he has a kind of deputy who he sends out to go and find a lake so that he won't have the glory of winning it. And he gets, for his work on the frontier in Armenia, he gets elected a fellow of the Royal Geographical Society. And then he turns it down because he feels that this will raise his profile too high. So again, I think that you can see that this is a genuine instinct. And so the love of women, I mean, Lytton Strachey assumes that he's gay, which, as you say, may well be a reflection more of Lytton Strachey, who was gay, than Gordon, yeah. Because it actually does seem that Gordon's shyness is around women.
Yes, he's incredibly shy around women, except for his sister, who he's got an older sister, I think, that he confides in.
But the attempt to control his sexual needs are focused on women.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think it's pure speculation, the idea that he's gay. And it goes hand in hand with all this stuff about the boys. But just because you are kind to small boys and educate them and are charitable, it doesn't mean that you necessarily have sinister motives.
And we should say that he's kind to small girls as well. And he's very kind to the elderly too.
Yeah, so it's a really interesting thing. Because, of course, now our instincts when confronted with Victorian philanthropy, the cultural sort of expectation now is that it will be exposed as mere hypocrisy. And it's all a cover for something else. But in Gordon's case, I think there's every reason to think it is absolutely heartfelt and genuine. You know, he doesn't do it for fame. He doesn't do it for attention. The thing about his sort of sexuality that I think we can say is that he does have clearly some, he's one of these people who has a sense of, is disgust too strong? This sense of revulsion from his own body. He talks later on about how
about the eunuch thing.
The body is a mere sheath for your soul that will be discarded later on. And he has
But this is theologically bred as well. So again, the question of whether, that's a heretical.
It's kind of Gnosticism, isn't it?
It is. It's verging on Gnosticism, the idea that the body itself is corrupt. I mean, that's not what conventional Christianity teaches. But he does hold to that because he's essentially self-educated as a Christian. And so he reads the Bible over and over again. I mean, he has an incredibly rich knowledge of scripture, but it leads him into kind of some faintly heterodox opinions.
That's right, yeah.
And so the question then is, well, does he arrive at the heterodox opinions because that, you know, he's prompted by his sexuality to do that, or vice versa? And I suppose we live in a post-Freudian age where our instinct is always to assume that one's belief in scriptural theology is determined by one's sexuality. But I think that it's possible to overdo that.
Yeah. I think what we can say, though, Tom, is that when he meets people, particularly later in his life, I mean, they meet him and they're like, oh, you're Chinese Gordon. You're the fellow who commanded the ever-victorious army, this great adventurer. And then he just starts banging onto them about his kind of heretical ideas. And lots of people at the time, not just subsequently, lots of kind of senior military people and administrators, they think he's completely mad.
Yeah.
And this is one of the fascinating things about him, that even at the time, people say, well, he's brilliant and he's a genius and he's incredibly brave and has complete integrity, but he's also a lunatic.
Well, or a saint.
Yes.
And,
well,
and so the margins between lunacy and saintliness, even in the Victorian period, are quite fine. So anyway, that's a kind of general, I guess, kind of scan of Gordon's psychology. We've dealt with that in 5 minutes. But before we come to the break, why don't we just get him to China?
Okay.
Because it's in China that he first becomes famous.
So his first big thing is when he's in his early 20s, he gets sent to the Crimea. And there he makes a name for himself. He's very brave. He actually says later on, oh, I'd hoped to be killed when I was... I mean, it's hard to know how much this is true of him in the Crimean War.
But So Strachey kind of casts that as a death wish.
Yeah.
But again, you can see that as bred of his understanding of theology.
Yeah, so, because he thinks it's the gateway to heaven, doesn't he?
So Garnet Wolsey, who he meets, who is also in the Crimean War, young Irishman, who will go on to become a very, very eminent general. And in fact, the man who leads the expedition to try and rescue Gordon in 1885. And he says that life to Gordon was but a pilgrim's progress between the years of early manhood and the heaven he now dwells in, the home he always longed for. So I think it's perfectly possible to see Gordon's bravery and his willingness to court death as an expression of his conviction that when he dies, he will be joined with the Saviour.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough. So anyway, he goes to the Crimea and there he kind of does this. He's a great surveyor and a kind of engineer, basically. So he will kind of crawl out of the trench and crawl close to the Russian trenches and sketch their forts. And he's brilliant at that. I mean, he's a brilliant kind of sketcher of opposition, of enemy positions and so on. Physically, he's not a kind of strapping person by any means. He's quite slight. He's quite nondescript, except for these people talk about these piercing kind of grey blue eyes. And people are struck by them even at the time. In the Crimea, he picks up his one big vice, which is cigarette smoking.
Yeah, I didn't realize that cigarettes...
No, neither of us
knew
this,
Tom. Introduced at the Crimean War.
Yes, we've both learned something from doing this podcast. So yeah, that cigarette smoking became a big thing with the Crimean War. He becomes a complete addict. You know, he's a chain smoker. So he's distinguished himself in the Crimea as a surveyor and as a kind of engineer. And he's then sent to the Danube as a surveyor to kind of help sketch out the frontier between the Ottoman and Russian empires, the new frontier at the end of the Crimean War. Then, as you say, he's sent to Armenia, where he slides down Mount Ararat.
That's right.
Mount Ararat, and sort of slides down it. I mean, that perfectly captures the man, doesn't it? Because it's the combination of kind of
but also he,
religiosity and demented adventuring.
But also Ararat, you know, Ararat is the mountain on which Noah's Ark is meant to have landed. But Gordon doubts that. So this will also become a theme.
Yeah, he knows better.
Yes, exactly.
He's a great man for discovering biblical locations, isn't he?
As we will find out.
And then, so he has all these sort of adventures. He goes and meets Kurdish villagers and he goes to Tbilisi, the capital of Georgia, and so on. And then in the autumn of 1860, he goes to China. And China is in the throes of the most extraordinary convulsion.
Well, Dominic, let's take a quick break here. So, and when we come back, tell us what the great convulsion that's going on when Gordon arrives in China, what it is. We'll see you in a few minutes.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost 3 decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, "Senator," I said, "you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school?" Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, "I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii." Okay. And I looked at him. I said, "You're done." I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, welcome back. We are talking Gordon of Khartoum, but before he became Gordon of Khartoum, he was known as Chinese Gordon. And Dominic, I interrupted you by going to a break. You were telling us what the convulsion was that China was afflicted by when he arrives.
So China is a bit of a basket case in the 19th century. It's involved in two different wars at once at this point. One is the Second Opium War. So basically, the British and the French are trying to open up China and seize kind of treaty ports. And
so they can flog them drugs.
So they can, yes, we can sell them drugs. Yeah. And that's going to culminate in the burning of the Winter Palace in Peking, Beijing, at which...
that's 1858.
In which Gordon is present, along with Sir Harry Flashman, who meets him at the end of the book, Flashman and the Dragon.
Well, you know, this whole way through, I've been thinking that Gordon is a kind of... upstanding Flashman.
He is.
Because he goes everywhere, doesn't he?
Yeah, he has exactly. He has that same kind of trajectory where he just keeps popping up in these strange places.
But he very strongly disapproves of the burning of...
He doesn't approve of it at all. And actually, in the Flashman book, he's there as a sort of pale eyewitness. He just comes in briefly. But you're right, he doesn't really approve of this.
And he disapproves of the French looting.
Yeah, the looting, it was just shocking.
Doesn't like looting.
Yeah.
So all these kind of things that... that people now hold against the British Empire. So
he's
the idea
of
looting stuff.
Yeah.
You know, we hear a lot about with reference to British museums holding imperial loot. This isn't entirely a 21st century perspective. It's Gordon had that perspective as well.
Yeah, I mean, snowflakes like Gordon were complaining about it in there. Sorry, yes. Tom, you walked into that one. Right. But that's not really the big story. No. Extraordinary as it may seem. The big story is the Taiping Rebellion, which is more your kind of thing, Tom, because it's mad Christianity.
It is.
Do you want to tell us about the Taiping Rebellion?
So the Taiping Rebellion is, I mean, carnage. A guy called Hong Xiu Quan, I hope I pronounced that.
That's beautifully done.
Some approximation to how it should be pronounced. Essentially decides that he's the younger brother of Jesus. And for very complicated reasons that I would need to spend more time in the Bodleian studying, basically the whole of China goes insane and agrees with him. And the Taipings, as they're called, the Qing dynasty is absolutely up against it because of the Opium Wars and general kind of disitude. The Taiping Rebellion is a murderous, horrific, bloodthirsty process of civil war.
But it's also a kind of religious crusade, isn't it?
Kind of. And so a lot of people in Britain think that it's Protestantism coming to China. And so there's quite a lot of enthusiasm in Britain for the Taipings, despite the fact that they're basically murderous and
well, could you not see the Taiping Rebellion and the creation of the Mahdist kind of state in Sudan? They're both places where Christianity and westernization and modernization and imperialism have arrived with a great shock in the kind of mid-Victorian period, and kind of traditional structures have been splintered. And these are ways of trying to react to
Well, and you know who pointed that out was actually Strachey. So Lytton Strachey drew the analogy between Hong Xiu Quan and the Mahdi
I'm disappointed to find that I'm in the
both,
same...
They began, both began as religious reformers, ended as rebel kings.
Right, well, I wouldn't have thought of us as similar people, but clearly Lytton
but
and I are.
Specifically, the issue and why the British, and specifically Gordon, get sucked into it, is that the Taipings are menacing Shanghai.
Yeah, and the bankers and merchants there.
European merchants.
Basically raise their own little army, the ever-victorious army.
Which is a great name for an army, isn't it?
It makes it sound absolutely fantastic, but actually it's a really ragtag, shambolic band of kind of mercenaries and drunkards, and it's commanded by this American guy called Frederick Townsend Ward, who does seem to be quite, doesn't he? He wears a frock coat, and I think he's quite a dashing figure, Frederick Townsend Ward. He meets Flashman and Flashman and the Dragon. But he's killed, I think, and his successor is a French-American adventurer called Henry, I don't know how to pronounce it, Bergwein, I don't know. Anyway, he's a complete drunkard. And so they boot him out, the sort of the bankrollers of the ever-victorious army. It's quite small. It's only about 5,000 or 6,000 people. They boot him out.
Mostly Chinese, right?
Yeah, lots of them. And not all Chinese, but yes, mostly Chinese, yeah. Exactly. They boot him out, and they want somebody else to do it. And basically they ask around who's around in China, and the British give them Gordon. And that's it showed that the Ever Victorious Army is probably better known than it should be in some ways, because it's quite a small outfit. And the reason the fact that they give them Gordon tells you it's not that important, because Gordon has actually never led an army into battle before. I mean, he's an engineer and a surveyor.
Yeah, he's an artilleryman, isn't he?
Yeah, exactly. So he doesn't really know what he's doing, but he turns out to be very good at it, to be good at commanding.
Well, because there are lots of rivers and canals and all kinds of stuff, and so an ability to draw maps.
Yes.
Which Gordon's very good at.
And they're all sort of steaming up and down rivers and stuff like this. But also he's very strict, isn't he? He's a complete disciplinarian. He bans hard liquor and so on. And he takes his
pay cut and he gives it to his troops.
But he has this extraordinary persona where he always goes into battle smoking a cheroot. And he carries a cane.
And unarmed.
Yeah, he goes in unarmed. He carries this cane, doesn't he? What do they call it? His magic baton or something. Can't remember what they're...
Well, so again, Lytton Strachey, who, you know, we've said is a bit of a bitch, but actually, saying about Gordon, he seemed to pass through every danger with the scatheless equanimity of a demigod.
Yeah, it's a very impressive... I mean, this is very impressive stuff.
It's very cool, isn't it?
You know, at one point, the artillerymen mutiny because he won't let them loot, and he manages to kind of brazen that out.
Then, which again is a kind of something that happens throughout his career.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, he fixes those gleaming blue eyes and people just crumble.
People are always, he's always going into situations where lots of armed men want to kill him. Yeah. And he turns up with his cigar and they all just sort of say,
and his love of Jesus.
Because
it all works.
His sort of sanctity, it is like a kind of protective kind of veil, isn't it? Do you not think? I mean, people don't quite know what to make of him.
And I think both the Chinese and in due course, people in the Sudan are stunned by his chastity as well. So
yes.
The sense of him as a demigod is Strachey's word, that this is someone who is very, very unusual and has a kind of almost supernatural quality to him. And that combined with his evident military talents means that basically within 18 months, he's won an absolutely crushing victory.
Yeah.
Taipings have all been booted out.
So the Taipings are defeated by the Imperial Army, the sort of Qing Army, plus the Ever-Victorious Army. Now, I think the role of the Ever-Victorious Army is probably a bit inflated, and that certainly Chinese histories don't give it as much weight by any means.
Well, but isn't that partly because the Taipings are seen as precursors as the communists?
That's right, Tom. That's right. But actually, when you look at the numbers involved, you know, there are hundreds of thousands of men in sort of on various armies in the field. It's implausible that Gordon's little band is decisive factor. But I think
he gets this incredible distinction.
Yes.
The Yellow Jacket, which is only 20 mandarins in the whole of the empire have it.
Yeah.
And Gordon gets given it.
So the Order of the Garter, isn't it? It's the Order of the Garter of China, basically.
Yeah. And I think he's the only non-Chinese person to have it.
Yeah.
And so I think that is... You know, one can take the revisionism too far.
Maybe.
I think he was clearly seen by the Chinese themselves as incredibly impressive. And so he's what, 30 by this
point? Yeah, he's about 30, isn't he?
And so he's been given this incredible award by the Chinese emperor. He's commanded an army, and then he has to go back to England. And he's unbelievably famous, and he hates it. He hates the fame. He hates the celebrity. And
what happens to him? He spends the next 6 years basically repairing forts in Gravesend.
And helping out raggedy
boys. So he's sent to Gravesend, which obviously had always been, yeah, because of its importance, so naval, sort of coastal importance, had always been very heavily defended. And they basically say to him, go and sort out these forts and, you know, modernise the defences and stuff. But he knows as well as everybody else, they're never going to be used.
It's never going to happen.
I mean, it's a complete waste of his time. I think they
so
just
he
don't
gets
know.
Up early, doesn't he? Has a cold shower.
Yeah.
Then he goes out and Bible. Does good, reads the Bible, goes and supervises the fort, and then he spends all his afternoons doing good.
Yes, and clearly he's a bit. There clearly is some point at which he's feeling a bit miserable that life has or fate has turned against him and doesn't know what to do with himself. But then he goes to a dinner party. Did you see this? He goes to a dinner party in Greenwich. And as luck would have it, while he's dressing for dinner, his gaze falls on the open pages of the Bible.
Yes.
So he's a man who reads the Bible while dressing for dinner, basically. And he sees the first epistle of St. John, whosoever shall confess that Jesus is the Son of God, God dwelleth in him and he in God. And on seeing this, he's kind of a man transformed.
Yeah.
He says, gosh, all I need to do is believe in Jesus as the Son of God. I mean, it's sort of real evangelicalism, isn't it?
And it's from that his philanthropical exercises proceed.
And he becomes very excited about the philanthropy. So in Gravesend, he sets up this little sort of, it's almost like a school, isn't it? They have mm-hmm. they meet twice a week. He teaches all
and
these boys.
And he calls boys. The boys Wangs.
Now that might sound.
Again, may raise eyebrows. But
he calls them his Wang because in China, a general or a chief was called, a warlord was called a Wang. And so he had Wangs in his ever-victorious army.
So that could be misinterpreted.
And the boys, obviously, you can imagine the boys probably think it's hilarious and brilliant that they've been called Wangs. And he does, they do have prayers, they sing hymns, he gives them bread and soup and stuff, and they do their lessons. And then he places them in work.
So in ships, doesn't he?
In ships. So there'll be a ship's boy and all this. And he has a big map, as you said at the beginning of the episode. Mm. He has this big map. And every night, you know, he and his Wangs gather around. And he gets one of them to chart where the other boys, you know, the old boys, are on the map. I mean, I think that's all actually pretty sweet and admirable.
I think you've got to take, you know, do you take this being born again, this sense that God's grace has come upon him seriously, or do you not?
Well, and John Pollock's book, Gordon, the Man Behind the Legend, a very kind of admiring biography of Gordon. He has quite a lot of quotes from the old boys of the Gordon Academy, ex-Wangs, who basically say, Gordon changed my life. You know, I owe him everything. It was wonderful. He was such a great man, you know, all this sort of stuff.
So,
I mean, he's not Jimmy Savile. Let's put it that way.
Well, there's actually this, the week that this is going out. So I think, I can't remember whether it's on, the day of his birth, 28th of January, or his death, 26th of January, but there's a ceremony at Gravesend, in front of the statue of him there. So he's still remembered there.
That's nice.
It is nice, I think. Anyway, so we're not being cynical about it.
I'm definitely not cynical about Gordon. I think Gordon is, at this point,
a Christian
say,
hero.
Well, the philanthropy is incredibly impressive, I think. Yep. I mean, I wouldn't do it myself.
Because of course not.
I'm far too selfish and lazy.
Of course,
I mean,
you've got
no intention of doing
it. You keep the money. But he's being paid quite a lot and he gives it all away, as he does throughout his entire life. Do you know what, Dominic? We've spent 40 minutes.
We haven't got very far.
Well, so Gordon's great phrase, inaction is terrible to me. So he's been to China. He's been in Gravesend. He's, you know, hanging out with the Wangs. Now comes the point where he goes to the country that will really make him famous, which is the Sudan. And so tomorrow we'll come back and we will talk about Gordon's career in the Sudan, the two times that he goes to that country. If, however, you are... a member of the Rest is History Club, you don't need to wait because you can listen to the whole thing today. Incredible value. So we will see you in 30 seconds if you're a member of the Rest is History Club, and we'll see you tomorrow if you're not.
We should call them our Wangs.
I like that.
If you're a Wang, you can carry on listening. If not, too bad. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.